This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The first human genome cost a whopping $2.7 billion. Now a whole genome sequence costs somewhere in the ballpark of $1,000. And if you just want a limited peek at your genes, enough to determine your ancestry, well, you can get that done for just $99. And there are trucks running around on the streets of New York that will do that for you almost immediately. But now that cost is no longer a barrier, it makes the test a lot more accessible. The question is, are we ready to deal with the results? Let's say you agree to participate in a genome research study, anonymously, of course. Well, what happens if the researchers find a risky gene in your sequence? Do they have an obligation to try to communicate that to you? Even if you don't want to, do they have the right? And what about your family members who might share that problematic gene with you? Do they have a right to know? My next guests have been debating these issues and focusing on families' right to know. Susan M. Wolf is the McKnight Presidential Professor of Law, Medicine, and Public Policy, University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira.
Dr. Robert Green is a medical geneticist at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Med School in Boston. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Green.
Great to be here.
We won't be taking calls today, but you can tweet us at SciFry, S-E-I-F-R-I. Let's get right to this. Dr. Wolf, can you give us an example of how this family issue has come up in the past where doctors might have wanted to give the results to, let's say, a family member, but they didn't have the permission and so on?
Sure. Let's say they're doing a genetic study or a genomic study, and they discover that their participant has a variant of the BRCA gene associated with higher risk of breast and ovarian cancer. And they go back to that person and they say, you know, we think it's important for you to know this, but we're also concerned about your sister or your brother and other members of your family. And the participant says, look, thanks, I want it, but I really, that's it. I don't want to share it more broadly within the family. That faces the researchers with a potential dilemma. If they really think, my gosh, this information has the potential to be really useful to the family members, they can have more frequent mammography, depending on family history. If there's a lot of breast or ovarian cancer, they may want to consider even preventive surgery. But here is this darn participant who, for some reason, is saying, it's my information. You have an obligation, researcher, to protect my privacy. Forget it. I don't want it disseminated within my family. That's a real problem.
And what about if that person who, you know, had the gene test is no longer alive? You can't really appeal to them anymore, can you?
Exactly. And the design of genomic research studies increasingly is to keep the information, to archive it. And if you're in a cancer research study, to keep perhaps a specimen of the tumor and continue the research so we can keep learning over time. So particularly in cancer genomic studies, I'm hearing from a lot of colleagues, the participant has passed away. Now what are we supposed to do with the information? There really are no established best practices yet, even for asking the participant while they're still alive, hey, what do you want us to do with this information after you die? Should we share it with family members or not?
Mm-hmm. Robert Green, how do you balance a patient's right to privacy with the obligation to do no harm? Would it not be doing harm to withhold the results from a family member?
Well, it's tough to set procedures for this in the research world because we don't really have very good procedures for this in the clinical world. And most of the time, we sort of set our procedures in the research world from what we're doing in the clinical world. So right now, in the clinical world, when you identify an individual with a dangerous mutation, who perhaps one of these mutations that leads to cancer, because they actually have cancer, it's really up to that patient to tell their family members. We actually see in genetics clinics people who say, for whatever reason, I don't want to talk to my family about this. And you know those family members are out there essentially in danger because they don't know about their genomic variant that puts them at risk, and this particular patient isn't interested in talking to them. So this is a problem at the clinical level, and it's a problem at the research level, as Susan has described, and I don't think we have a really good answer for it yet. And this is perhaps one of the areas where the research world is actually going to lead the clinical world, because I think we do have to think about genetic disease as more of a family-based issue rather than an individual-based issue, as we've always considered most of the rest of medicine.
So is this a personal ethical issue among researchers and clinicians then to decide which way to go, there being no standard about what to do?
No, there's pretty much an existing standard in clinical practice right now that the wishes of the individual patient in front of you supersede your duty to contact the family. Though you can certainly apply a lot of elbow grease and you can sit down with them and you can explain, you can give them letters to hand the rest of the family, and you can, you know, use your time and energy to try to turn them around if you think they're making a bad decision. But it's not considered unethical at this point in time. In fact, it would probably be considered unethical to disclose this to family members without the patient's permission.
Susan, why would a family member not want to tell another family member about this?
Great question, Ira. There are a lot of reasons. One is there may be assumptions within that family about who's really genetically related to who, and the person who is deciding not to share may know better. They may know perhaps of an affair, so that some of the assumptions about who's the dad, who's the genetic dad, don't really apply, or undisclosed adoption. But there's a whole other layer to this, Ira, which is families. Families are just complicated, and it may be that the person whose genetic information it is isn't speaking to her sister or doesn't like her brother. And you get into that world. You also get into one other layer of complexity, which is sometimes this erupts, as Robert was saying, in the context of a person who's struggling with a lethal cancer. And so you sometimes hear them say, look, I'm maxed out. I can't get into all this family complexity and other stuff that's not even related to my cancer enough already. I don't want to deal with it, and I don't want to authorize the sharing.
Could the fact that you who are privy to the diagnosis of the gene diagnosis, the gene test, could the fact that you want to get to the family members sort of tip off the family members that there's something they should know about, even if they don't hear from you?
I think sometimes family members do realize that their loved one is involved in a genetic study. There are also genetic studies and genomic studies that are designed actually to include the family. For example, what's called trio testing. If you have a child who's affected by a cancer that is not responding to conventional treatment, and then you want to do a genomic analysis to look for more treatment targets, or a kid with a really puzzling neurodevelopmental anomaly, and you're trying to understand it as a researcher or clinician, and it would help to also sequence the parents to really isolate what is the genetic problem going on here. Sometimes there's already a network of family members involved, tipped off to the fact that, hey, there's some analysis going on. What about us? And you do hear of cases where the family members initiate contact with the researcher or the clinician saying, look, we're here. We want the info, too. Mm-hmm. And then the researcher has to balance their obligations to protect the privacy of their key research participant or patient against these family demands.
Robert Green?
Yeah, and this also works much more easily when you're talking about a vertical family structure. So if you've got a child who is affected and you, as Susan said, you're trying to test a trio, then you sort of naturally expand the genetic testing into the parents with their permission on behalf of the child. By the same token, if you are testing certain adults and you find something, they are much more interested in trying to find out whether their children are affected, whether their children are carrying this. There's a natural instinct to find that out. I think where it gets more dicey is siblings, grandparents, cousins, you know, the more distant relatives, which may involve all these family dynamics Susan was referring to.
Is it any less dicey if I tell you, as someone with my analysis, that I don't want to know certain things, and we're talking just about me, and you find something that you think that you should tell me, but I don't want to know? Is that a less of a quagmire?
I think it is less of a quagmire if the clinician or the researcher is absolutely certain that you understand the kind of information that you're turning down. And that's a big if, because I think that some people may say, I don't want to know because they're overwhelmed, or they may say, I don't want to know because they're frightened. But if you then turned around and said to them, you know, I do have a piece of information for a condition that might be treatable, might be preventable, they may say, okay, well, you know, tell me. Or they may next week or next month or next year come back and say, tell me. So it's a tricky thing to of course, we have to respect autonomy. Of course, if somebody says, I absolutely don't want to know, I think we have to respect that. But it's a tricky thing to make sure that person truly understands the nature of the information they're turning down.
But and if you go back to that person and say, I really need to talk to you, don't they get the message that there's something that they should know?
Yes, I think they do get the message, Ira. And I think this is actually an active area of funded research. How do you get a real decision out of people, whether they want to know or they don't want to know, without pressuring the heck out of them and without essentially signaling so heavily that you've got a big, bad, ugly variant that they really feel compelled to receive it? We do need to respect autonomy, as Robert said. And some people are going to say, I do not want to know. And imagine if you were a patient fighting pancreatic cancer, which still has a terrible prognosis. You know, average survival from diagnosis is only about 6 months. And you really say, I don't want to deal with the rest of this. I think we need to respect that.
Mm-hmm. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour with Dr. Susan Wolfe, a McKnight Presidential Professor of Law, Medicine, and Public Policy at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. Dr. Robert Green, medical geneticist at the Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Med School in Boston. We're talking about your right to know and people's right to know about their genetic tests and what their results are and how that affects their families. Susan, let's talk about the legal side of this. Can doctors get in trouble or illegally in making a decision?
They can get in some trouble. You know, the way this family issue first broke was through a number of court cases in the 1990s. For example, a woman sued her father's physician saying, hey, you knew my dad had colorectal cancer. You knew it was genetically based. You never warned me. And now I have it. What the courts dominantly said, because they didn't all agree with each other, was the doctor really has an obligation to protect the privacy of the dad's information. It's the dad who's the patient. But the doctor rightly would warn the patient and say, you need to tell your offspring that this is heritable. Once the doctor has alerted the patient of this need to tell the offspring, that's the end of the physician's obligation. Now, some patients are not going to warn. So there was still some agony about, well, what are we going to do in those cases? And the American Society of Human Genetics, for example, came out with advice to physicians dealing with this problem, saying there is a narrow zone in which you don't have a duty to breach the confidentiality of the father's information, but you have the option. You have a privilege to warn, but it's only in the cases where warning is highly likely to avert immediate and serious harm. So actually, the colorectal cancer scenario wouldn't qualify because it's unlikely to be immediate harm being averted. Now we have a whole federal privacy law, HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. And that has some provisions that basically say my health information is private and it stays private even for 50 years after my death. But there are some exceptions. For example, if my relative's physician comes forward and says to my physician, hey, you know, I really need Susan's genetic information to help me diagnose the brother. But that's still a very controversial exception. We're still sorting out the law on this.
And how is it going to get sorted out? Do you think it's eventually a Supreme Court ruling as we bang this back and forth in legal battles. Robert, do you think that's where it's going to wind up?
Well, actually, I think it's going to get sorted out a different way. I think that we are in a unique historical moment where thousands of genomes are being done for rare diseases in mostly children, some adults, in the clinical sphere, and tens of thousands of genomes are being done in the research arena, and they are discovering things that apply, as we've said, to relatives. Now, why this is a unique historical moment is because I think in 5 years or maybe 7 or 8 years, the cost and the availability of well-interpreted genomes will be so ubiquitous that anyone who's interested in finding out this information about themselves can readily and easily find out about it. Right now, there's this sort of artificial barrier of cost, accessibility, no reimbursement, somebody's in a research study and somebody else is not, that creates this discordancy between the availability of the information to an individual and the availability of the information to their family. So I'm hoping that the what someone called the glide path to ubiquity in terms of genome sequencing will solve this problem for us.
You think that... Yes, go ahead, Susan.
You know, I think it's going to lessen the problem. I think Robert's right, but I don't think it's going to solve the problem, because it's still going to be the case that if my genome is sequenced and you find a variant associated with malignant hyperthermia, which means I could have a catastrophic reaction to a commonly used anesthetic, you're still going to worry as the researcher or the clinician, oh my gosh, what about the family members? What about this brother who's scheduled for surgery? I mean, where's the red alert for him? So I think we're not going to completely eliminate that problem of sharing with family.
I think you're absolutely right, but I do think that there's going to come a time when nobody's going to go into surgery, Susan, without having that variant checked. So I think that there'll be a sort of ubiquity of clinical practice that takes care of some of these issues.
Could that also be brought up as a healthcare insurance cost, saying, you know, we're not going to insure the doctors or whatever who's doing the surgery unless we know what the genome says?
Absolutely. I think there could be a time when it's not appropriate to put someone under surgery if they haven't been tested for that variant. We already are seeing this in certain kinds of pharmacogenomic variants. It's still pretty rare because we don't have the evidence we need for many of the others. But we're occasionally seeing situations where it would now be malpractice not to check some sort of variant before you put an individual on a particular drug.
But I think there's another side, too, of the insurance problem, which is if I have my whole genome sequenced and the researchers discover all sorts of variants with health implications, will my insurance company cover clinical pursuit of all those variants? So now I'm at my doctor's office with this big printout saying, well, what are we going to do about all this? Should we have follow-up testing? Should my mammographies be more frequent? And then the problem is multiplied if that information fans out to my brother, my sister, my kids. So there's a health insurance coverage issue lurking here, too.
Absolutely. And, you know, any kind of screening program, and let's face it, we're talking about screening now with genomics, any kind of screening program adds costs. The real question is whether those costs are justified in terms of value and whether the value you get back is going to be detection and prevention of sufficient disease to warrant the cost. And those are active research questions that the Clinical Sequencing Exploratory Research Consortium, that our MedSeq project, that a lot of projects around the country are grappling with right now.
You know, we all hear stories about doctors over-prescribing tests. You know, and insurance companies are paying more than they should because doctors are afraid of being sued if they don't have this test done. Is this going to turn into another test that's going to be overprescribed?
I think it could. And there's another related issue, which is we haven't quite arrived at the point, Ira, where there are established universal standards for interpreting the genome. So you can get different answers out of different labs. And I think that's going to be a real challenge. There are people actively working on that. We need greater standardization so we're confident in the validity of the results, in the transferability, the clinical utility. These are kind of early days now on the genome.
Mm-hmm. I would completely agree. And I think, though, that the technical problems are going to be the easiest to solve. That's going to happen in a few years. There's going to be very clear validity to this. I think, as Susan alluded to, the much harder question is going to be, if you have this particular family structure and you have this particular variant in this particular gene, what the heck do we know about the risk and whether we should apply some sort of surveillance or even surgery to you? And that's going to be very hard, because every single person has got a slightly different set of variables walking into that equation.
But I would think that if we're getting to the time where everybody has their genome sequence, there'll be less need to have to know what your relative sequence is, because we'll have yours.
That's my point, yeah, that this historical moment in which some people have easy access to genome sequencing is going to pass, mm-hmm. and I think everyone who wants it is going to be able to get a genome that's sequenced, but as Susan pointed out, not always easily interpreted.
You're also...
Well, I think...
I'm sorry, Susan, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're still working on getting everybody health insurance in this country, so I think we're quite a ways from universal genome sequencing that's done at an early age so that everyone can use it. That's a vision of a possible future. But I do think we're still going to have this issue of one member of the family has had it. It has implications for other family members. They haven't had it yet. Now what?
Mm-hmm. But Robert, you're already involved in a project that sort of seems to do this, called BabySeq, which sequences newborns.
That's right. We're at least exploring it. And I think there are huge questions associated with whether it is appropriate and advisable to think about population screening with any form of genomic sequencing. And this applies to adults and to children. A subset of those problems are really acute when you start talking about sequencing newborns. So if you really believe in this, if you believe it's good for preventing disease as adults, then you probably believe it's better if you would sequence somebody earlier, maybe right as soon as they were born. And so we've been exploring this in a federally funded project, in an NIH-funded project called the BabySeq Project, in which we are planning to enroll newborn babies into two arms, one of which gets standard of care and one of which gets whole genome or whole exome sequencing that's interpreted back to their parents. And pending IRB review, we're going to be doing this in a couple of months. And we're going to actually do this with a big safety net in place so that we understand what the doctors are doing with the information, what the parents are doing with the information, how much extra cost this is adding to the entire health stream, and hopefully answer some of these very troubling questions with real data as this research study progresses.
Susan, what's your reaction to that?
It's a controversial study and a controversial move to start sequencing newborns. In the past, as we've thought about what should parents be able to authorize by way of genetic testing in kids, the consensus is that really should be limited to genetic results that are needed while the child is still a child, needed for their health care, and then wait on the rest. Things like BRCA that are really about later adult onset illness, in that case, risk of breast or ovarian cancer. The idea is that the kid is a separate person, and we need to protect their own autonomy, their own ability to decide when they hit 18 or 21 or later in adulthood, whether or not they want this added genetic information predicting risk, sometimes of very serious disease. So now if we're going to sequence, do a full genome sequence on a newborn, you've let the cat out of the bag. You've deprived the child of the ability to make those autonomous decisions later when they hit adulthood, and they may have a very different view from their parent about whether they want this information or not, and if so, when they want this information. So I am concerned that we're kind of throwing a child autonomy out the window in the name of getting maximal genomic information.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Do any of you think that the new Congress that is coming in, and with the control of the Congress and a funding of medical research and Republicans now total control, do you think that will have any influence on genetic studies?
Well, I dearly hope that funding NIH and the new genomic medicine, which we already know has enormous potential value for patients, will be a high priority. I mean, really, genomics is reorganizing, for example, our understanding of cancer. We used to think of cancer in terms of what organ is it manifesting in. There's breast cancer, there's ovarian cancer, there's lung cancer, there's colorectal cancer. Now, thanks to genomics, we are understanding it very differently as a pathway dysregulation disorder, so that a given variant, perhaps a change in a tumor suppressor gene, can have implications for multiple cancers that may show up in different organs. This is profoundly changing our understanding and our treatment options for patients. And it just is a mini demonstration in one disease set, in cancers, of how important genomic research really is.
Robert?
We have examples now of individuals with rare mutations who simply are resistant to Alzheimer's disease, and other types of mutations in different genes who are simply resistant to heart disease. And people are jumping all over these to understand how they work and then to develop treatments that can do the same things as the protein products or lack of protein products for these genes will do. So there are enormous implications for using genomics to fundamentally transform how we manage, how we prevent, how we treat disease. Mm-hmm. And I hope whoever's in control of Congress continues to recognize that and prioritizes federal funding of research.
How relevant are the genetic databases we have now at representing all ethnic groups? Are minorities out of luck if they get sequenced because we don't know what their risk genes might be?
So that's a huge problem. Right now, for historical reasons, the large databases that are used by all of the laboratories to explore genetic variation when they have a patient's genome in front of them and to compare them to are overwhelmingly white. And the ancestry of African Americans and other ancestry groups, other ethnicities, is actually quite different than the ancestry for European Americans. So the same sort of variant categorization does not always apply. So we're actually facing this very peculiar situation where there is a potential health disparity arising out of the very databases we use to apply genomic medicine. And that is an intolerable situation. It's a situation that has to be addressed. I think that Susan and I and others have been bringing this to the attention of NIH, and there are actually moves afoot to address it. But it's something we just simply cannot tolerate, and we cannot promote further by having sort of, I don't know, discriminatory practices in how we build our databases.
Susan?
It's related, too, Ira, to another problem, which is the failure to broadly share databases. The fact that a lot of these databases, which are really crucial for interpreting a genomic sequence, are proprietary or they're not shared. We need to be pooling these data so that we really avoid recreating the health disparities that have troubled other domains of medicine in genomic medicine. I mean, now is really the time to be funding the kind of work that assures we don't bring those disparities into the genomics world.
I'd like to thank my guest. Susan M. Wolf is the McKnight Presidential Professor of Law, Medicine, and Public Policy, University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. Dr. Robert Green is a medical geneticist at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Med School in Boston. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Ira.
Thank you very much.